praise of idleness. A great deal of harm is being done in the modern world by belief in the virtuousness of work, and that the road to happiness and prosperity lies in an organized diminution of work. First of all, what is work? Work is of two kinds. First, altering the position of matter at or near the Earth's surface relatively to other such matter. Second, telling other people to do so. The first kind is unpleasant and ill-paid. The second is pleasant and highly paid. The second kind is capable of indefinite extension. There are not only those who give orders, but those who give advice as to what orders should be given. Usually two opposite kinds of advice are given simultaneously by two organized bodies of men. This is called politics. The skill required for this kind of work is not knowledge of the subjects as to which advice is given, but knowledge of the art of persuasive speaking and writing, i.e. of advertising. Throughout Europe, though not in America, there is a third class of men, more respected than either of the classes of workers. There are men who, through ownership of land, are able to make others pay for the privilege of being allowed to exist and to work. These landowners are idle, and I might therefore be expected to praise them. Unfortunately, their idleness is only rendered possible by the industry of others. Indeed, their desire for comfortable idleness is historically the source of the whole gospel of work. The last thing they have ever wished is that others should follow their example. From the beginning of civilization until the Industrial Revolution, a man could, as a rule, produce by hard work little more than was required for the subsistence of himself and his family, although his wife worked at least as hard as he did, and his children added their labor as soon as they were old enough to do so. The small surplus above bare necessities was not left to those who produced it, but was appropriated by warriors and priests. In times of famine, there was no surplus. The warriors and priests, however, still secured as much as at other times, with the result that many of the workers died of hunger. This system persisted in Russia until 1917, and still persists in the East. In England, in spite of the Industrial Revolution, it remained in full force throughout the Napoleonic Wars, and until 100 years ago, when the new class of manufacturers acquired power. In America, the system came to an end with the Revolution, except in the South, where it persisted until the Civil War. A system which lasted so long and ended so recently has naturally left a profound impress upon men's thoughts and opinions. Much that we take for granted about the desirability of work is derived from this system, and, being pre-industrial, is not adapted to the modern world. Modern technology has made it possible for leisure, within limits, to be not the prerogative of small privileged classes, but a right evenly distributed throughout the community. The morality of work is the morality of slaves, and the modern world has no need of slavery. It is obvious that, in primitive communities, peasants, left to themselves, would not have parted with the slender surplus upon which the warriors and priests subsisted, but would have either produced less or consumed more. At first, sheer force compelled them to produce and part with the surplus. Gradually, however, it was found possible to induce many of them to accept an ethic according to which it was their duty to work hard, although part of their work went to support others and idleness. By this means, the amount of compulsion required was lessened, and the expenses of government were diminished. To this day, 99% of British wage earners would be genuinely shocked if it were proposed that the king should not have larger income than a working man. The concept of duty, speaking historically, has been a means used by the holders of power to induce others to live for the interest of their masters rather than for their own. Of course, the holders of power conceal this fact from themselves by managing to believe that their interests are identical with the larger interests of humanity. Sometimes this is true. Athenian slave owners, for instance, employed part of their leisure in making a permanent contribution to civilization, which would have been impossible under a just economic system. Leisure is essential to civilization, and in former times, leisure for the few was only rendered possible by the labors of the many. But their labors were valuable, not because work is good, but because leisure is good. And with modern technique, it would be possible to distribute leisure justly without injuries to civilization. Modern technique has made it possible to diminish enormously the amount of labor required to secure the necessities of life for everyone. This was made obvious during the war. At that time, all the men in the armed forces, all the men and women engaged in the production of munitions, all the men and women engaged in spying, war propaganda, or government offices connected with the war were withdrawn from productive occupation. In spite of this, the general level of physical well-being among unskilled wage earners on the side of the Allies was higher than before or since. The significance of this fact was concealed by finance. Borrowing made it appear as if the future was nourishing the present. But that, of course, would have been impossible. A man cannot eat a loaf of bread that does not yet exist. The war showed conclusively that, by the scientific organization of production, it is possible to keep modern populations in fair comfort on a small part of the working capacity of the modern world. if, at the end of the war, the scientific organization, which had been created in order to liberate men for fighting and munition work, had been preserved, and the hours of work had been cut down to 4, all would have been well. Instead of that, the old chaos was restored. Those whose work was demanded were made to work long hours, and the rest were left to starve as unemployed. Why? Because work is a duty, and a man should not receive wages in proportion to what he has produced, but in proportion to his virtue as exemplified by his industry. This is the morality of the slave state, applied in circumstances totally unlike those in which it arose. No wonder the result has been disastrous. Let us take an illustration. Suppose that, at a given moment, a certain number of people are engaged in the manufacture of pins. They make as many pens as the world needs, working, say, 8 hours a day. Someone makes an invention by which the same number of men can make twice as many pens as before. But the world does not need twice as many pens. Pens are already so cheap that hardly any more will be bought at a lower price. In a sensible world, everybody concerned in the manufacture of pens would take to working 4 hours instead of 8, and everything else would go on as before. But in the actual world, this would be thought demoralizing. The men still work 8 hours. There are too many pens. Some employers go bankrupt, and half the men previously concerned in making pens are thrown out of work. There is, in the end, just as much leisure as on the other plan, but half the men are totally idle, while half are still overworked. In this way, it is ensured that the unavoidable leisure shall cause misery all round instead of being a universal source of happiness. Can anything more insane be imagined? The idea that the poor should have leisure has always been shocking to the rich. In England, in the early 19th century, 15 hours was the ordinary day's work for a man. Children sometimes did as much, and very commonly did 12 hours a day. When meddlesome busybodies suggested that perhaps those hours were rather long, they were told that work kept adults from drink and children from mischief. When I was a child, shortly after urban working men had acquired the vote, certain public holidays were established by law, to the great indignation of the upper classes. I remember hearing an old duchess say, "What do the poor want with holidays? They ought to work." People nowadays are less frank, but the sentiment persists, and is the source of much of our economic confusion. Let us, for a moment, consider the ethics of work frankly, without superstition. Every human being, of necessity, consumes, in the course of his life, a certain amount of the produce of human labor. Assuming, as we may, that labor is on the whole disagreeable, it is unjust that a man should consume more than he produces. Of course, he may provide services rather than commodities, like a medical man, for example. But he should provide something in return for his board and lodging. To this extent, the duty of work must be admitted, but to this extent only. I shall not dwell upon the fact that, in modern societies outside of the USSR, many people escape even this minimum of work, namely all those who inherit money and all those who marry money. I do not think the fact that these people are allowed to be idle is nearly so harmful as the fact that wage earners are expected to overwork or starve. If the ordinary wage earner worked 4 hours a day, there would be enough for everybody, and no unemployment, assuming a certain very moderate amount of sensible organization. This idea shocks the well-to-do, because they are convinced that the poor would not know how to use such leisure. In America, men often work long hours, even when they are already well off. Such men, naturally, are indignant to the idea of leisure for wage earners, except as the grim punishment of the unemployed. In fact, they dislike leisure even for their sons. Oddly enough, while they wish their sons to work so hard as to have no time to be civilized, they do not mind their wives and daughters having no work at all. The snobbish admiration of uselessness, which, in an aristocratic society, extends to both sexes, is, under plutocracy, confined to women. This, however, does not make it any more in agreement with common sense. The wise use of leisure, it may be conceded, is a product of civilization and education. A man who has worked long hours all his life will be bored if he becomes suddenly idle. But without a considerable amount of leisure, a man is cut off from many of the best things. There is no longer any reason why the bulk of the population should suffer this deprivation. Only a foolish asceticism, usually vicarious, makes us continue to insist on work in excessive quantities now that the need no longer exists. In the new creed, which controls the government of Russia, while there is much that is very different from the traditional teaching of the West, there are some things that are quite unchanged. The attitude of the governing classes, and especially of those who conduct educational propaganda, on the subject of the dignity of labor is almost exactly that which the governing classes of the world have always preached to that which were called the honest poor. Industry, sobriety, willingness to work long hours for distant advantages, even submissiveness to authority, all these reappear. Moreover, authority still represents the will of the ruler of the universe, who, however, is now called by a new name, dialectical materialism. The victory of the proletariat in Russia has some points in common with the victory of the feminists in some other countries. For ages, men had conceded the superior saintliness of women and had consoled women for their inferiority by maintaining that saintliness is more desirable than power. At last, the feminists decided that they would have both, since the pioneers among them believed that all the men had told them about their desirability of virtue, but not what they had told them about the worthiness of political power. A similar thing has happened in Russia as regards manual work. For ages, the rich and their sycophants have written in praise of honest toil, have praised the simple life, have professed a religion which teaches that the poor are much more likely to go to heaven than the rich, and in general have tried to make manual workers believe that there is some special nobility about altering the position of matter in space, just as men tried to make women believe that they derive some special nobility from their sexual enslavement. In Russia, all this teaching about the excellence of manual work has been taken seriously, with the result that the manual worker is more honored than anyone else. What are in essence revivalist peers are made, but not for the old purposes. They are made to secure shock workers for special tasks. Manual work is the ideal which is held before the young and is the basis of all ethical teaching. For the present, possibly, this is all to the good. A large country, full of natural resources, awaits development and has to be developed with very little use of credit. In these circumstances, hard work is necessary and is likely to bring a great reward. But what would happen when the point has been reached where everybody could be comfortable without working long hours? In the West, we have various ways of dealing with this problem. We have no attempt at economic justice, so that a large proportion of the total produce goes to a small minority of the population, many of whom do no work at all. Owing to the absence of any central control over production, we produce hosts of things that are not wanted. We keep a large percentage of the working population idle because we can dispense with their labor by making the others overwork. When all these methods prove inadequate, we have a war. We cause a number of people to manufacture high explosives and a number of others to explode them, as if we were children who had just discovered fireworks. By a combination of all these devices, we manage, through difficulty, to keep alive the notion that a great deal of severe manual work must be the lot of the average man. In Russia, owing to more economic justice and central control over production, the problem will have to be differently solved. The rational solution would be, as soon as the necessities and elementary comforts can be provided for all, to reduce the hours of labor gradually, allowing a more popular vote to decide, at each stage, whether more leisure or more goods were to be preferred. But, having taught the supreme virtue of hard work, it is difficult to see how the authorities can aim at a paradise in which there will be much leisure and little work. It seems more likely that they will find continually fresh schemes by which present leisure is to be sacrificed to future productivity. I read recently of an ingenious plan put forward by Russian engineers for making the White Sea and the northern coast of Siberia warm by putting a dam across the Kara Sea. An admirable project, but liable to postpone proletarian comfort for a generation, while the nobility of toil is being displayed amid the ice fields and snowstorms of the Arctic Ocean. This sort of thing, if it happens, will be the result of regarding the virtue of hard work as an end in itself, rather than as a means to a state of affairs in which it is no longer needed. The fact is that moving matter about, while a certain amount of it is necessary to existence, is emphatically not one of the ends of human life. If it were, we should have to consider every navy superior to Shakespeare. We have been misled in this matter by two causes. One is the necessity of keeping the poor contented, which has led the rich, for thousands of years, to preach the dignity of labor, while taking care themselves to remain undignified in this respect. The other is the new pleasure in mechanism, which makes us delight in the astonishingly clever changes that we can produce on the earth's surface. Neither of these motives makes any great appeal to the actual worker. If you ask him what he thinks is the best part of his life, he is not likely to say, "I enjoy manual work because it makes me feel that I am fulfilling man's noblest task, and because I like to think how much man can transform his planet. It is true that my body demands periods of rest, which I have to fill in as best I may, but I am never so happy as when the morning comes and I can return to the toil from which my contentment springs." I have never heard working men say this sort of thing. They consider work, as it should be considered, a necessary means to a livelihood, and it is from their leisure hours that they derive whatever happiness they may enjoy. It will be said that, while a little leisure is pleasant, men would not know how to fill their days if they had only 4 hours of work out of the 24. Insofar as this is true in the modern world, it is a condemnation of our civilization. It would not have been true at an earlier period. There was formerly a capacity for lightheartedness in play, which has been to some extent inhibited by the cult of efficiency. The modern man thinks that everything ought to be done for the sake of something else, and never for its own sake. Serious-minded persons, for example, are continually condemning the habit of going to the cinema, and telling us that it leads the young into crime. But all the work that goes into producing a cinema is respectable, because it is work, and because it brings a money profit. The notion that the desirable activities are those that bring a profit has made everything topsy-turvy. The butcher who provides you with meat and the baker who provides you with bread are praiseworthy, because they are making money. But when you enjoy the food they have provided, you are merely frivolous, unless you eat only to get strength for your work. Broadly speaking, it is held that getting money is good and spending money is bad. Seeing that they are two sides of one transaction, this is absurd. One might as well maintain that keys are good, but keyholes are bad. Whatever merit there may be in the production of goods must be entirely derivative from the advantage to be obtained by consuming them. The individual, in our society, works for profit, but the social purpose of his work lies in the consumption of what he produces. It is this divorce between the individual and the social purpose of production that makes it so difficult for men to think clearly in a world in which profit-making is the incentive to industry. We think too much of production and too little of consumption. One result is that we attach too little importance to enjoyment and simple happiness, and that we do not judge production by the pleasure that it gives to the consumer. When I suggest that working hours should be reduced to 4, I am not meaning to imply that all the remaining time should necessarily be spent in pure frivolity. I mean that 4 hours work a day should entitle a man to the necessities and elementary comforts of life, and that the rest of his time should be his to use as he might see fit. It is an essential part of any such social system that education should be carried further than it usually is at present, and should aim, in part, at providing tastes which would enable a man to use leisure intelligently. I'm not thinking mainly of the sort of things that would be considered, quote, highbrow. Peasant dances have died out except in remote rural areas, but the impulses which cause them to be cultivated must still exist in human nature. The pleasures of urban populations have become mainly passive, seeing cinemas, watching football matches, listening to the radio, and so on. This results from the fact that their active energies are fully taken up with work. If they had more leisure, they would again enjoy pleasures in which they took an active part. In the past, there was a small leisure class and a larger working class. The leisure class enjoyed advantages for which there was no basis in social justice. This necessarily made it oppressive, limited its sympathies, and caused it to invent theories by which to justify its privileges. These facts greatly diminished its existence, but in spite of this drawback, it contributed nearly the whole of what we call civilization. It cultivated the arts and discovered the sciences. It wrote the books, invented the philosophies, and refined social relations. Even the liberation of the oppressed has usually been inaugurated from above. Without the leisure class, mankind would never have emerged from barbarism. The method of a hereditary leisure class without duties was, however, extraordinarily wasteful. None of the members of the class had been taught to be industrious, and the class as a whole was not exceptionally intelligent. The class might produce one Darwin, but against him had been set tens of thousands of country gentlemen who never thought of anything more intelligent than fox hunting and punishing poachers. At present, the universities are supposed to provide, in a more systematic way, what the leisure class provided accidentally and as a byproduct. This is a great improvement, but it has certain drawbacks. University life is so different from life in the world at large that men who live in an academic milieu tend to be unaware of the preoccupations and problems of ordinary men and women. Moreover, their ways of expressing themselves are usually such as to rob their opinions of the influence that they ought to have upon the general public. Another disadvantage is that in universities, studies are organized, and the man who thinks of some original line of research is likely to be discouraged. Academic institutions, therefore, useful as they are not adequate guardians of the interests of civilization in a world where everyone outside their walls is too busy for un-utilitarian pursuits. In a world where no one is compelled to work more than 4 hours a day, every person possessed of scientific curiosity will be able to indulge it, and every painter will be able to paint without starving, however excellent his pictures may be. Young writers will not be obliged to draw attention to themselves by sensational potboilers, with a view to acquiring the economic independence needed for monumental work, for which, when the time at last comes, they will have lost the taste and the capacity. Men who, in their professional work, have become interested in some phase of economics of government will be able to develop their ideas without the academic detachment that makes the work of university economicists often seem lacking in reality. Medical men will have time to learn about the progress of medicine. Teachers will not be exasperatedly struggling to teach by routine methods things which they learnt in their youth, which may, in the interval, have been proved to be untrue. Above all, there will be happiness and joy of life, instead of frayed nerves, weariness, and dyspepsia. The work exacted will be enough to make leisure delightful, but not enough to produce exhaustion. Since men will not be tired in their spare time, they will not demand only such amusements as are passive and vapid. At least 1% will probably devote the time not spent in professional work to pursuits of some public importance, and, since they will not depend upon the pursuits for their livelihood, their originality will be unhampered, and there will be no need to conform to the standards set by elderly pundits. It is not only in these exceptional cases that the advantages of leisure will appear. Ordinary men and women, having the opportunity of a happy life, will become more kindly and less persecuting and less inclined to view others with suspicion. The taste for war will die out, partly for this reason, and partly because it will involve long and severe work for all. Good nature is, of all moral qualities, the one that the world needs most, and good nature is the result of ease and security, not of a life of arduous struggle. Modern methods of production have given us the possibility of ease and security for all. We have chosen, instead, to have overwork for some and starvation for others. Hitherto, we have continued to be as energetic as we were before there were machines. In this, we have been foolish, but there is no reason to go on being foolish forever.
You left your coffee on the windowsill, lipstick on the rim, fading, but it's still you. I keep your jacket on the empty chair, like you just stepped out, you're almost there. Every street I walk feels like a line towards you. Every quiet thought leads into the truth. If we meet tomorrow, would you know my face? Or just feel the echo of a missing place? If we meet tomorrow, pictures frozen in that ear, smiles that knew the storm long before it near. I hear your laughter in a stranger's tone, one wrong turn away from coming home. Like headlights in the rain, blinding for a breath, and I'm alone again. If we meet tomorrow, would you know my face? Or just feel the echo of a missing place? If we meet tomorrow, like strangers softly care for, kind of fall like constellations back into the sky we left behind. If I say I'm sorry, would you touch my hand or turn with all the memories we never planned? If we meet tomorrow, can we change the end? Rewrite every almost, turn a ghost to a friend. If we meet tomorrow, and I call your name, will we break the sorrow, or light it up in flame? If we meet tomorrow,
number you have reached is not in service. This is a recording. 1-1-1-1-1.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi.
Away from the microphone. Out in Signal Land, we have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex.
You do. Good evening.
Well, we have no overtime tonight because we are just too damn busy preparing for major events and our organization of a whole lot of people and things like that. Not your problem, it's our problem. We're going to figure it all out. But boy, are we busy. It's simply incredible. And we have, a few stories to talk about. I really, 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 really don't want to talk about this guy anymore. He just seems to inject himself into every damn story. He's ruined the World Cup, and now apparently .gov websites are also on the list. Great story in Ars Technica. I just would like to recommend people read the story entitled Trump's Plan to Redesign Every .gov Website Leads to AI-Designed Horrors. Oh, boy. It's as bad as you think it could possibly be, maybe even worse. I'm just going to read the opening part. Maybe we can discuss a little bit, but not a whole lot. Trump's plan to fill the digital potholes and use AI to quickly redesign every government website isn't going very well. I don't know if anybody's surprised by that. Now, last August, he created the National Design Studio, or NDS, created it by executive order, a temporary Doge-like entity that answers only to the president. NDS was tasked with creating new standards to update the U.S. web design system, which we all know as USWDS. That's a thing. That really exists. The plan was to overhaul 27,000 .gov websites in just 3 years. At the end of this so-called America by Design initiative, the government's design language would supposedly be more usable and beautiful. That is how they described it. However, that monumental task assigned to a small team under a short time frame was seemingly made harder by Doge's deep cuts to agencies previously responsible for improving government websites, including dismantling the 18F technology unit and restructuring the U.S. Digital Service into Doge. Those teams knew exactly how hard it can be to get every government agency to adopt new web standards. They had spent years trying to push agencies to update their sites to comply with the USWDS standards, yet only 30% of government websites use them as of mid-2023. That's according to NextGov, notably the USWDS team, which was created in 2015 to ensure government websites were accessible and mobile-friendly. That team was reduced to one full-time employee after Trump took office. One person is doing all this. Most people agree that updating government websites is a worthwhile and necessary endeavor, but about a year into NDS's existence, the team hasn't accomplished much. You know, the team is one person. Let's not put too much pressure on them. Or maybe we just shouldn't have them. Its biggest accomplishment has been modernizing the federal retirement system. However, former government workers have accused the Trump administration of claiming false victories and overstated credit. Well, that's a new thing. Noting that the project was underway before NDS was created. Before, after, time, you know, people really get hung up on the most trivial of things. The group's other output has been meager, with few launches and substantial backlash from design experts. Yeah, you don't want the backlash from the design experts. I've learned that. They argue the team relies too heavily on AI, has failed to test sites for compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act, as scrutiny of NDS has intensified. Most agencies are now resisting connecting with the team about adopting new web standards. There are a bunch of interesting websites listed here, and Alex, I think of you whenever I see a weird .gov site, because they're all over this this Ars Technica article. There's live.gov, there's onlyfarms.gov, there's aliens.gov, which we discussed a few weeks ago. There's why.gov. Okay, wait, I have to ask, what is why.gov? I mean, I ask that question every day, but I'm curious what it means, what they do on that site. Maybe one of us can check it out. It's not going to be me. Alex, go ahead.
Well, why.gov? What the hell is this? This is some kind of strange thing. Oh, is this?
Are you on it now?
Oh my God! You don't even want to know what why.gov is.
You did this from your house. You did this from your house, Alex.
Oh,
where are your brain and your ass? Come on.
This is so bad.
Don't connect from your house, for God's sake. That's rule number one.
I'm using a VPN that goes right through your home router, Emmanuel, so I'm all good.
Oh, we're all going down.
Yeah. Now, why.gov is pretty horrifying. It's all like horror stories about illegal aliens and things. And literally, I had no idea that existed. But
okay, explain to me the why.
I guess it's, you know, all these people that are, it's stories of victims of crimes associated with illegal aliens. So my guess is that's the why. Why did this happen? I don't know. Gila, you look like you have some insight into this.
Unfortunately, I've been reading very quickly.
Please put illegal aliens in air quotes when you say it, because that's their term. It's a dehumanizing term, and I really don't like it.
Why.gov redirects to whitehouse.gov/why with the tagline being, "This is our why," and it's talking about, it's not just talking about what they call illegal aliens, but it also talks about people who have died from fentanyl and other synthetic opioids, which is legitimately terrible, and it's a lot of pictures of people holding pictures of their dead children, which is just awful. And it's stories of people's dead children, which is just awful.
What the hell is wrong with these people? What are they doing? I still don't understand the why. I really don't.
I think people are suggesting that the current occupant of the White House is going to stop the flood of synthetic opioids. And the why they're supporting this man is because of his tough on crime perspective, if I had to guess.
Okay.
And I hope you heard the air quotes around everything.
I heard a lot of air quotes, yes. Well, maybe I could suggest another .gov site, MerryChristmas.gov. Yeah, that's one, too. It includes one page for each of the 12 days of Christmas, an apparent vanity project. Rather than a government resource, the site is also a celebration of NDS designs and culminates on Christmas with a page praising the group for building sites reflecting a belief that thoughtful design can strengthen democracy and improve civic life. My God, I feel like I'm in North Korea. I really do. And I've been to North Korea, so I know what that feels like. Just the singing praise, and I expect megaphones to be installed on the street corners soon. They're hard to get, trust me.
Well, look, to go back to this issue with respect to the NDS or the National Design Studio and this idiotic notion of trying to downsize human beings at the same time improve efficiency through redesigning all of the .gov websites. I mean, this is premised on so many incredibly idiotic assumptions, I have to say. I mean, if you think about, you know, just about every .gov website, everything that turns up in the .gov zone file, we've talked about that. There's kind of weird things that we find and interesting things that we find going away from the .gov zone file, but they're all wired into law, into budgets, into casework, into actual human lives, and trying to auto-redesign websites across the government, across agencies, across departments. You know, it's like trying to hot swap an electrical system in a hospital when surgery is in progress. I mean, these are like living, breathing sites that actually do things with people. A lot of them have interconnected portals that go to databases, that go to systems. I can't imagine how many things are going to break if you try to do this at scale. And it'll break one after another after another. To do this in the manner that they are proposing, to just have AI go through and redesign all these sites, it's operating under this incredibly idiotic assumption that all of these pages, that they're just landing pages. They just have text and things on them. No, they're all interconnected in some way or another, especially if they provide or are associated with any kind of essential services that people rely on. I think this is a really idiotic, really dangerous thing for Trump to do.
I could just jump in for a quick second. The thing I find fascinating about NDS is who's there. Everybody who failed out of DOGE went to NDS for the most part. Big Balls, was that his name?
Yeah, Big Balls. What's he up to?
He's working for NDS. And
wait, is he the full-time staffer?
No. I think there's one full-time staffer at USWDS. I think they shrunk it down to that. But basically, everybody who failed out of DOGE is in NDS now. I was reading further in this Ars Technica article. Everything's AI. Nothing is ADA compliant. They're trying to get, if you want to go to vote.gov to check where your polling site would be, they're trying to direct that through login.gov, and they'll check you against the Homeland Security database before they give you the location of your polling place.
See, this is what they are trying to do, and this is what everybody listening should be really concerned about. When they say, you know, voter ID, it's so simple. They want to track you. They want to collect your identity. All these things that are completely unconstitutional as far as running elections. Elections are run by the states. The states decide this. Now, to federalize all that and to create massive databases and keep track of everybody, that is very, very dangerous. And they don't tell you that. They don't tell you that it's not a simple thing of simply flashing your driver's license. No, you have to get enhanced ID. You have to get your birth certificate. Good luck tracking that down. I know a lot of people don't know where theirs are. And it's designed. It is designed to keep people from voting. To narrow it down as much as possible. You have a married name, that's going to be a challenge. And a lot of people just won't take the time. You don't have a passport, a lot of people don't. You're not going to get one just to go vote. It's expensive, it's inconvenient, and it is intrusive because they will be keeping a database throughout the entire country. And we all need to be fighting this. We all need to realize how dangerous this actually is.
But wait, there's more.
Oh, I'm sure there is.
Oh, there is. This is my new favorite. So a lot of the stuff that's in this Ars Technica article came from a Guardian article that published a few days ago, or a few days previous to this article. Guardian's reporting also confirmed that four federal sites built by NDS, ndstudio.gov, trumprx.gov, realfood.gov, and trumpaccounts.gov, run, quote, commercial visitor tracking software that's, quote, configured to evade the privacy tools many web users install.
And that should tell you everything you need to know about their motivations. Really should. you know, we've been tracking things like this for years, decades. And we always try to let our listeners know when something is dangerous, when something is violating your privacy. This government is doing that. They don't care if it violates the law. They don't care if it's technically clumsy. They just want to profit and to violate privacy and just benefit themselves, tear the country apart. Doesn't matter. All right, I said I didn't want to talk about him very much, and I don't, but there is one more thing I just want to mention, and Alex, I think you'll appreciate this. A federal judge today ordered that the writer E. Jean Carroll should promptly receive a $5 million jury award days after the Supreme Court rejected an appeal by Trump, and despite his last-minute attempt to get the justices to reconsider. I didn't know if the Supreme Court ruled on something you could appeal to the same people. I didn't realize that. But, of course, Trump gets whatever he wants, so he got them to reconsider. I don't know if they reconsidered yet. But the two-page order issued today was from a Judge Lewis Kaplan of Manhattan Federal Court. He cited the Supreme Court's June 29th order denying Trump's request that the justices review the matter, and that cleared the way for the funds, which Trump had deposited with the court, to be released to Ms. Carroll, which is the very, very least that can be done at this stage. But the thing that makes this story interesting and relevant is the name of the judge, Judge Lewis A. Kaplan, who was my judge during the DECSS trial of 2000. Fond memories of that hot courtroom. It was July, I believe, of 2000. Ultimately losing the case, being glared at by Judge Kaplan quite a bit. Hey, this clears everything, I think. Just he's doing the right thing here. Any thoughts, Alex?
Yeah, Judge Kaplan, again, I mean, he's had quite a few cases before him that were really momentous, I think. And remember, you didn't just lose before Judge Kaplan. You also lost in the Second Circuit as well.
You didn't need to bring that up, but sure, okay. Yeah, lost in two different courts. All right, and yeah, I probably would have lost in the Supreme Court had it gone to there. So I could have gotten a hat trick, but we didn't decide to do that.
Maybe, but the caption of the case was Universal Studios v. Ramirez, I believe, even though it's known as the 2600 DCSS.
That was the poor guy who was initially indicted or charged, and then the federal government said, hey, wait a minute, we've got hackers here. Let's go with them instead, because that'll certainly get the public on our side. And they were right. That's kind of how you do it, but the name was never changed. And that's okay with me, you know, so it's someone else's name on that case. But yeah,
I mean,
we did lose the case, and it was the wrong decision. But you know, technology marches on. People have figured out a way to get around these ridiculous rulings.
Well, I think if the case was brought today, might have worked a different result ultimately, right?
Well,
I think
people wouldn't know what a DVD is for one thing.
Yeah, that's right. Might have been just a totally moot issue at this point. But let's just say it was about encryption and it was about code and whether or not code could be free speech. I mean, this case is still cited to this day, known as the 2600 DCSS case, you know, about the proposition as to whether or not code, source code, can be equated with speech. So, you know, I think maybe it was just a bit of ahead of its time. It was 26 years ago. Which, you know, was a totally different world at that point. But, you know, the fact that Lewis Kaplan is still on the bench, still cranky, still issuing orders, and I think he's doing what he's supposed to be doing,
Isn't every judge cranky, though?
You know, most of them are. I have found some that should be crankier than they are as well. Like, there's one judge in the Southern District of New York that I think just tolerates far too much gamesmanship from various people. And should get angry, and some judges get angry, you know, at the drop of a hat.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, judges have to really call it like they see it, right? And I think Lewis Kaplan is calling it like he sees it. I mean, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, and you got to call it out for what it is. And so, you know, Lewis Kaplan, I think, you know, we have to applaud him in some ways. He's doing a good job being a good federal judge, being objective, and doing what he's supposed to do, which is be the bulwark of this republic, pushing back against tyranny.
All right, and that concludes our critique of current rulers of our current regime. It brings us to another theme of the program tonight, which is old technology. Great article in the Times today entitled Fax and Telegram, New York's Archaic Requirements Get an AI Overhaul. I'll just read the beginning of it. Should a serious boiler accident occur on one of New York's last steam trains, state law requires operators to notify the Department of Transportation as promptly as possible, but only by phone or telegram. Yes. Can you even send a telegram anymore? I'd like to try. Organizations looking to amend their charitable bingo licenses must remember to print out 3 copies of their application to the Gaming Commission. Those hoping to appeal Department of Conservation findings on wetlands will need 6. And despite the widespread access to email, there are more than 350 instances where the law requires documents to be transmitted via fax or the United States Postal Service. I didn't know that was archaic, but I guess it's becoming that way, and we'll have some examples of that coming up, too. Now, these are just a few of the outdated and burdensome requirements that have been flagged in a new artificial intelligence project ordered up by Governor Hochul. The effort is called Regulatory Reset, and it'll deploy AI to comb through roughly 18 million words of codified statute to find references to fees, signature or notary requirements, fax, mail, telegraph, and other outdated technologies, as well as task forces, councils, and mandatory reports. We have laws on the books that require a special permit for a woman to work later hours, said Ms. Hochul. It's New York Times, and that's how they refer to the governor. No wonder people get so frustrated. So I'm getting rid of that. I guess it kind of makes sense, right? You approve, Kyle?
Yeah, I kind of like the idea of just sort of accelerating a lot of stuff that would take a really long time to draw connections and make sense of. So, like, using what's available to increase the analytic ability of a big bureaucracy like the state of New York just seems like a fair use or a normal use that, of course, you'd hope was supervised and not something that's audible and but no less important. Like, it's a great way to use the resources to make the institution and the processes of it more usable themselves as the general public interfaces with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, there are lots of examples here of things that are just outdated, whether it's the way people are referred to or the technology. They focus on the absurdity of maintaining a fax machine in 2026. I take exception to that. I happen to have a fax machine. It's plugged in. Nothing really comes across, but it's there. It's there if you need it. What I'm impressed by is that fax technology hasn't really changed at all. I mean, I'm sure people are sending color faxes, but I don't get any of those. Mine look the same as they did in the 1980s. I don't have thermal paper anymore, but some of this technology. But the telephone, is the telephone considered outdated technology to most of us? I know it is to many. Many people don't have landlines, and they think it's antiquated technology. But there's another article in the Times called 8 Ways to Create a Light Tech Summer for Your Kids. And guess what? People are embracing the old technology and realizing that this is a way to reclaim some of your time. They have all of these examples. They have the original portable communicator. It's a Midland T10 X-Talker, a pair of tiny, lightweight radios that perform almost as well as sets that cost 5 times more and maybe even more amusing for kids. Yeah, it's a walkie-talkie, and this is what they are recommending for kids to get through the summer. There's the tin can. This plug-in corded phone is screen-free and designed to let kids communicate with family and friends without a smart device. Demand is high. Current orders won't ship until July. It's a telephone. It's a damn landline, but they're treating it like it's something brand new, and people are getting really, really excited about that. The tin can. They actually have a name for it, and it's not telephone. It's got a long, curly cord that connects the handset to the base. It's a pastel color. It basically is a return to that time of long, rambling conversations. And it's for kids, because, well, we're lost, I guess. There's no hope for us, but there is hope for the children. Gila?
If I could quote a line from the book of Ecclesiastes, which seems kind of relevant at this particular point, right? There is nothing new under the sun. Everyone thinks they've discovered something new. There's a camera that is marketed for kids who are at summer camp and aren't allowed to have screens. It is a screen-free camera. And shockingly enough, it looks like the camera I had when I was little. Oh my goodness, do I see a walkie-talkie?
Yeah, I was just going to mention, I really like this idea. Things like video cameras and photography, like you're mentioning, and other ways to do things like communicate, they're really fun, and you can really let people check them out, like that might not otherwise be exposed to it because all they have is like tablets and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I completely agree with that myself. We've had these little toy walkie-talkies that they don't cost anything. They're really cheap, and you can get them at big box stores. Sometimes when Kyle and I are in different vehicles, driving to various places, we communicate that way, and it's really efficient. It's kind of cool. A lot of fun.
What about CB radios?
Oh, no. I've never been into CB radios. But no, I don't, a lot of people are. I don't know if people still talk on them. Alex?
Yeah. I had a CB radio in my car just to see if people were still using these things a couple of years ago. And I have to say, you know, people still do. It's mostly truckers. And there's this whole line of communication that happens while you're along the highways. The truckers still talk to each other. They talk about where the cops are. They have their own lingo for various things that they see. So, for instance, you know, like if there's a cop, they call them, what do they call them? Do you know what they call them?
Yes. Bears. They call them bears.
Yeah, or a Smokey, right?
Smokey the bear. Yeah.
And then if you have a Smokey Rollin' Discos, what's a Smokey Rollin' Discos?
I don't know. Go ahead, Gila.
Is it a cop car with its lights on?
Absolutely. You got it.
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, well, that's like an active chase or something like that. Oh, there's a Smokey Rollin' Discos up at Mile 228.
You know what a Volkswagen Bug is called?
No.
A roller skate.
Oh, yeah. I can see that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That makes sense. Yeah. But it is pretty cool. I would encourage people to check out CB radio when you're driving. It's a way to talk with the truckers.
Well, how do you check out CB radio while you're driving? You have to get a CB radio, don't you?
You got to get a CB radio. Yeah. You got to get an antenna and a CB radio, install it in your car. You know, all
the
these things will
work. Antenna
on
your car.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah. And then just start talking. You have various channels. I think Channel 9 is still the emergency channel for CB radio, I believe. But it's neat
there's 40 channels. Do people really use 40 channels?
Not really anymore. I don't think so. There's not a lot of chatter amongst everything, but, you know, it is neat to be a part of these conversations that are happening all around you while you're driving.
I would just add, you don't have to necessarily be in a car. You could install a CB radio, like, in your treehouse or on the back of your bike or something. You know, like, there's plenty of ways to get it configured.
Have you ever seen anybody riding a bike on a CB radio?
Yeah, all the time.
I see them on their phones all the time, but a CB radio...
It's a phone?
That actually might be safer, though. They're just holding the microphone, a corded microphone, and the CB radio is attached to the bike, rather than holding a phone and sometimes without steering at all.
Well, maybe miniaturization has come to the CB world. We're just not aware of it.
Well, you know, CB radios are not included on this list for some reason. They skipped over those.
Well,
that's unfortunate, because they would come with nicknames, too.
Yeah, you know what? It's... what better way for your children to meet total strangers over the air?
Part is actually one of the funnier parts of CB radio, because if you are on the roadway a lot, I mean, I remember a parts delivery person talking to me about this, and they had their own nickname, based on like the color of their car and stuff like that.
And you know what? CB predates the modern hacker culture. People were using nicknames in the CB culture before hackers were using nicknames in the hacker culture. I know, you know, there are exceptions to that. You know, hackers go way back, I know. But for the most part, you know, in the 1980s, that's when it really started to take off. That's when a lot of handles were created for the first time. Gil?
My grandparents had CB radios in their cars. They would drive in tandem between the city they lived in and a slightly larger city that was about an hour away, and they would communicate via CB radio the whole trip. And I remember learning about this when I was 4 years old, and my grandfather's CB handle was Banana Man. Banana Man, because my grandparents owned a grocery store and grandpa specialized in produce. So Banana Man. I was 4 years old and didn't understand the difference between a CB radio and a walkie-talkie. So every 30 seconds, I hopped on the CB and said, Banana Man, what's your 20? Because I just thought it sounded cool. And then I found out that other people were also on the same band, and I got in trouble and had the microphone taken away from me.
Well, how did you get in trouble? You don't need a license to be on the CB.
No, but I was told I was hogging the airwaves because I thought it was just a way to talk to my grandparents in the other car.
How powerful was your rig?
Yeah,
I'm using terminology. That's true.
We had a really tall antenna on the car. I remember this distinctly. And yes, I was told that I was tying up the line and was not allowing other people to speak.
That's such a parental phrase, tying up the line, when it's a CB radio.
4 years old. They needed me to stop talking.
Well, hearing a 4-year-old on a CB channel might have annoyed some people if it was incessant, I guess.